This episode of HPC Wire Soundbite is sponsored by NVIDIA, the inventor of the GPU. NVIDIA's Tesla GPUs are designed to accelerate HPC applications. Learn more by visiting NVIDIA at SC11, www.nvidia.com/SC11.
This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry, with Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Oak Ridge makes Jaguar into a Titan.
And a new platform for IBM.
Hello, everyone, and good morning for HPC Wire Soundbite for October 14th, 2011, available every Friday on iTunes and Stitcher. I'm Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and I'm joined once again by Addison Snell of Intersect 360 Research. Hey, good morning, Addison.
Good morning, Michael. Big week this week. A lot of stuff coming down all in one day.
Yeah, big news. It was a short week, and we had the sort of the holiday there Monday, but then, yeah, it just seemed to rain big HPC news. And to start off, I mean, the Oak Ridge story, the Oak Ridge National Lab announced that it had signed that deal with Cray to build their 20 petaflop Titan supercomputer, the thing that's been talked about for a while, but nobody had formally announced that it was Cray, although I think we all knew that.
Right. It was pretty easy guess that Cray would get the upgrade to Jaguar, and I think it's up to 20 petaflops, right?
Up to, yeah. We'll talk about a little bit of that in a second.
There's some options in there.
Options, yes. But it's going to be the first U.S.-based petascale computer to employ GPUs, and we knew that as well.
Right. Well, NVIDIA is very excited about it, did a lot of the PR. Yep. NVIDIA is a PR dynamo in this industry. I think they got the story into the Wall Street Journal, which unfortunately neglected to mention Cray in the whole thing. But
nice.
It's congratulations to Cray and AMD and NVIDIA all around and Oak Ridge themselves.
Right. Yeah. It's a big deal for AMD and big deal for NVIDIA and Cray. So, yeah, exciting news. And they revealed some of the details on that. And actually, we both got a chance. We talked with Buddy Bland and Jim Hack, two of the directors over there at Oak Ridge. Let's listen on what they had to say about it. So today we have with us Buddy Bland, project director of Oak Ridge Leadership Computing Facility at Oak Ridge National Lab, as well as Jim Hack, director of the National Center for Computational Sciences at Oak Ridge. Guys, congratulations on the announcement this week about Titan, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. We're delighted to be here with you.
So you guys just announced, I mean, you've talked about Titan for a while, obviously. It's been in the works, it seems like, for years. But you announced the contract with Cray on Tuesday, and a lot of the details, what was going to go into the machine. So this, like I said, the system's been in the works for a while. I think I heard about it, must have been a couple of years ago already, and it's been going on for longer than that. You guys saw the vendor roadmaps early on, obviously. You had privy to that information. So in the announcement, there was some ambiguity about sort of how big this system would be. You talked about 10 to 20 petaflops, and as far as how many nodes would be retrofitted, you're going to build this on top of Jaguar, basically. As far as the XK6 blades going in and the GPUs, it's all going to be incorporated and built from that. But what's your best guess right now for the size of the system petaflop wise when it's all said and done?
Well, Michael, we are in the process right now of upgrading all 18,688 compute nodes in Jaguar from the XT5 nodes that we have today to the XK6 nodes that Cray announced this summer. All of these nodes will have AMD's new Interlagos processor. And so that'll be 18,688 Interlagos processors at 2.2 gigahertz. So that comes out to about 2.5 petaflops, slightly more of the Opteron petaflops. On the GPU side, we will have initially 960 of those nodes will have NVIDIA's Fermi GPUs. And so when we put that together by the end of this year, we expect to have about 3.3 petaflops peak performance. Now, there's a second phase to this. Next year, we will upgrade by adding NVIDIA's next generation Kepler GPU. We'll remove the Fermi GPUs. We'll put in Kepler GPUs. And our contract right now calls for about 10 petaflops, well, 10 petaflops of GPUs, not about, 10 petaflops of GPUs. But that we have many options in the contract to be able to add more GPUs if the budget allows. We all know we're in a challenging budget environment right now, and based on the best information we have on the budget, we'll be able to do at least 10 petaflops of GPUs, perhaps as much as 20 petaflops of GPUs.
Now, Buddy, you, as Michael pointed out, you were considering a lot of, or you were privy to a lot of the roadmaps for all the technologies for the for Titan going forward. Were you looking at any alternatives to GPU computing, and do you think Oak Ridge is going to ride GPU computing into the future all the way to exascale?
We have been looking at GPU computing for a long time now. We started this project in the spring of 2009. At the time, the GPU computing was very new. People were just starting to use that. But we started this by looking at what our users require. And what our users have been telling us that they require is more memory bandwidth per node. They want fatter nodes, so very high-performance nodes, not more nodes. And we looked at the various architectures that were available to us at the time in 2009 and have continued to update that roadmap throughout the time since then. And we see that the GPU is the best device available for us today to be able to get to the performance we want and meet our users' requirements for a very high-performance node with very high memory bandwidth.
So having made that choice to go with GPUs, Jim, what kind of GPU computing program models did you guys decide to use, or multiple ones? I mean, there's CUDA out there, there's OpenCL, there's high-level compilers now that sort of incorporate real compilers around some of those technologies. What do you think is going to be used at Oak Ridge to develop all these applications and port them over?
Well, our strategy, because it needs to be a longer-term strategy, is that none of the current state-of-the-art programming models are going to be abandoned. We want to make sure that they're all supported in one way or another. We want to minimize the impact on the refactoring of codes for the user community so that they can be portable. They won't necessarily be able to make use of a system without GPUs on them, but they are the effort that's invested in implementing these codes, you know, won't go to waste. So the main message is that we're pursuing all avenues. Things like CUDA and OpenCL that are being used will continue to be used, but where we can use directives with compilers and other tools, we're going to use them to migrate our critical map applications over to Titan. I think the most important message in terms of our strategic goal is that we are trying to work with the users to refactor or restructure their codes that exposes hierarchical parallelism so that there's more parallelism exposed inside the node in order to get those, as Buddy called, fat nodes to perform better. So the idea is that we're reaching a transition right now, a transition point architecturally, and a lot of it's driven by power and the cost of moving data around the system. And so the more that we can get the users to exploit data locality and work inside the node before having to communicate off the node, the better. And that's really going to be the test of how effective the system will be.
Well, when we talk about how effective the system will be, Jim, I think a big thing that gets everyone excited is thinking about what kind of science you're going to be running on Titan. Are there particular application areas that you're really excited about, and are there certain codes that you think will really benefit from GPU acceleration as opposed to ones that'll do well on CPU only?
There are a range of applications, or say a class of applications that are in the realm of what's called, they're partial differential equations that tend to lead to many degrees of freedom that occur per, say, discrete point. When you discretize the problem, the more degrees of freedom that you can identify, the better that application would run in this kind of a GPU environment. So there are many codes in our portfolio of applications that meet that criteria. We've identified a half dozen or so. We've set up a set of code teams to start migrating these codes over. Ultimately, we expect the GPU architecture to be have an advantage for all code, but we have identified a few to start with in order to establish best practices for how to make the migration to this hybrid environment.
We're making the world a better place through faster partial differential equations, Jim. I love it.
Can I add a little bit here, Addison, on that? One of the areas that we've really focused a lot of our effort on is working on taking the BLAS libraries and the Scalapack and the LAPack and all of the various scientific libraries that are heavily used by our users today, and working on very high performance versions of those that will run on the GPU. So even if you don't do anything except for call libraries, you'll be able to get a reasonable amount of performance out of the GPUs. But by refactoring your code, exposing this hierarchical parallelism, we expect the compilers ultimately to generate most of the code that will run on the GPUs. And that's really important to us because the users who run at our center also run at other scientific centers that are run by the Department of Energy as well as the National Science Foundation. We don't have a single architecture of computers at all of these centers. And so the codes have to be portable and they have to be performance portable. And so by exposing the parallelism with directives and then having the compilers generate the right instructions for whatever architecture you're going on, we expect to see a lot of performance boost on all the various architectures using our codes.
Yeah, I think that's an important point that Buddy makes, is that the effort that's invested, even given the fact that this is a GPU-oriented path forward, the effort that's invested to expose that type of parallelism in these codes will in fact improve their performance on existing as well as, I suspect, all future architectures. So this is not a wasted effort to ask the science community to start thinking a little bit more carefully about issues of data locality.
Well, obviously this is going to be a really interesting system to watch over the next few years as it gets built out and then goes into production in late 2012 or early 2013. And we're going to be watching it. So, guys, best of luck on this endeavor. It's exciting work, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Buddy and Jim, congratulations. Thanks very much for joining us. Well, I was delighted that we got a chance to talk to Buddy and Jim from Oak Ridge, especially because you and I had some questions specific to the fact that this was the first petascale GPU-based super in the U.S.
Right, and while they couldn't nail down, like, I really wanted to know how big this thing is really going to be, but it looks like the money is still, you know, a little up in the air as far as what the DOE is going to be able to provide. We sort of got the min-max there. So minimum 10 petaflops, maximum above 20. And the way I figured it, and I wrote about this in my article,
I think the min was 10 petaflops just to the GPU, right, plus the CPU portion.
Plus the CPU,
so the minimum has got to be somewhere around 12 or 13.
Right, 12 and a half, right. And right,
I'm sorry, you were saying you were writing about it.
And right, so I was writing about this because at the maximum, if they retrofitted all the Jaguar nodes with the Kepler GPUs, and I used pretty conservative math there, it would be something closer to 30 petaflops, between 25 and 30, if they got the funding to upgrade all of those nodes to Kepler GPUs eventually. And hopefully they will. That'll be obviously a very impressive system, and with the latest NVIDIA technology, it'll be a very interesting one.
Well, and you know, there's a few things I like about this, Michael. First of all, it wasn't too long ago, going into, you know, the end of last year and early this year, you and I talked a few times on the podcast about the role of the U.S. in the global supercomputing market and how we were falling off quite a bit. Now we're talking about Titan. We just talked about Stampede. Right. The replacement for Blue Waters will probably be announced soon. So, you know, it's starting to feel like there's a little bit of momentum coming back into these U.S. supers.
Right. I mean, there was never any doubt in my mind that we were going to build multi-petaflop supers, and GPUs would be a part of that. I mean, you mentioned Stampede. That's actually the Intel Mic technology, and that's an all Intel. That's basically Intel CPUs and Intel Mic. And in this one, they just happened to get Intel got snuffed out. I mean, it's AMD and NVIDIA, but I think we're going to see a bunch of different vendor technologies in these multi-petaflop systems, and they're all going to be interesting, and they're all sort of going to be competing for mind share, and it'll be interesting to see which ones sort of prevail, I think.
Yeah, well, and it's starting to feel like the race to exascale is really on here. People are starting to think ahead toward what are those systems, what are those architectures going to be. NVIDIA does an excellent job of describing the new types of science that are available at levels of exascale in their presentations. And I guess if there's one thing in the interview I would have liked a little more of is we were asking about what kind of applications, and they're saying, well, partial differential equations and linear algebra, right? And I've got a math background. I get that, and I get that that's the math behind these big applications. But I would have, loved to have heard them talk about, curing disease, preventing tsunamis, and, reducing infant mortality rates around the world or something.
Yeah. Well, these science guys are very humble. Until they get the codes out there and working, I think they don't want to be go into hyperbole. But yeah, I think it'll be, they're working on those codes. I wrote a little bit about it in the article about which codes that they're working on in climate and other areas. So we will see some scaled up codes using these GPUs and some interesting results, I think, at the sustained petaflop level and above. So.
Yeah, oh yeah, I don't doubt it. And it's a very exciting system. We're looking forward to continuing to follow it.
Well, let's take a little break and we'll come back with our second big story of the week.
Accelerate your HPC application with NVIDIA Tesla GPUs. As a companion processor to the CPU, Tesla GPUs are designed from the ground up for HPC and deliver industry-leading performance per watt. To learn how Tesla GPUs can accelerate science and engineering, visit NVIDIA at SC11, www.nvidia.com/SC11.
So, Michael, we're back from that break, and same day that Titan was announced, there was an announcement on the vendor side.
Right. IBM announced they had the intention to buy Platform Computing, a stalwart in the cluster grid management arena.
This is big news. You're taking the number one system vendor in HPC, which is a huge company with these big Smarter Planet initiatives, and they're buying the company that's the leader in middleware for this market.
Right. Platform is the most established company in this market. They've been around almost 20 years. They're successful, privately held company. This is not a startup that IBM's picking up for chump change. I mean, these guys were making in tens of millions of dollars in revenue a year, and they didn't say how much they paid for it, but I'm sure it was substantial. Interesting buy. I was not expecting it. What do you think is the most interesting aspect of this deal?
I'd have a hard time narrowing it down to just one thing, Michael. I mean, I guess if I did, I'd have to look at the breadth of the portfolio that Platform has. I mean, they've got a long heritage with LSF. Having LSF coming out of IBM now might get some people to raise their eyebrows, but it's a very successful, well-used program. But then beyond that, they've had a lot of stuff for grid. You remember they had a Platform Globus product, and then going into cloud, and then their Symphony lines, their Platform HPC lines. They've kind of got Platform products throughout the whole middleware sphere, and there are other companies that overlap with them in specific areas, but no other one that I think has Platform's breadth in middleware.
Right, I'd say that's a very accurate description. Right, they're into distributed computing in the large sense. I mean, clouds, grids, clusters, the whole thing, and different aspects of those products. So
one of the questions I had going into this was, what would be the fate of these products as they went into IBM? Would this get broken up and scattered throughout IBM because they fit into different pockets? And that's not what's going to happen. They're staying all in the same group within IBM, in this system software group. the management of platform computing, IBM is going to said is going to stay intact. So that's good news again. But now lets them sell this stuff side by side with complementary IBM products, because IBM sells its own fair bit of middleware.
Right, but I mean the question is, to me, when I looked at this, why are they actually doing this? They could sell those. They're partners with Platform now, and they were selling them side by side before. They were bundling them. Now they can maybe bundle them more cheaply now since they own the IP, and they can do some more integration. They can do all these fancy things. But I mean, it's not like they couldn't use this technology before. It was available. They're strategic partners. My question is how's it going to affect the other strategic partnerships the Platform had with IBM competitors like HP and Dell especially and Cray?
Yeah, I think that, you know, at the middleware level, middleware already tends to come from a lot of different places. But in terms of what motivated this for IBM, I think we've reached an inflection point where there's so many of these technologies now that apply in broader enterprise a broader enterprise markets than just HPC. When you look at the expanding nature of big data and clouds going well beyond HPC, private clouds, that IBM sees the ability to leverage this technology into more areas than Platform might have been capable of bringing it into just on its own. So I think that's the timing aspect of it there that you were talking about. Now is why it makes sense. Now is that's the reason why it makes sense to do this now. As opposed to later.
Yeah, I'm not all sure about that. I think from what I heard, at least on the press teleconference they had, I think they still want to focus this product set on technical computing, HPC, however you want to define that. I'm not sure how much they're going to move it into commercial enterprise outside of that area, because they've already got some products, for one thing, in that area. Now, they could consider merging those technologies, but that's not the feel I got, at least publicly, from what they were saying. What I got out of that was they looked at this as a business deal. They saw this and thought, you know, with our sales and marketing half, IBM's thinking they can make this market a lot bigger. They can sell a lot more product than Platform could do, just simply because they're a global company with a huge sales team and a lot more customers and a lot more tentacles into partnerships, clients, and the whole deal. I think they did this just as a business deal. I'm not sure how much synergy they really expect to get out of this technology.
Well, you could be right there, Michael, but I think there are synergies to be had when you look at the map of how Platform middleware starts to fit in and around other IBM pieces. I think there are some synergies there, not to say it doesn't make sense strictly from a business standpoint and how they can sell more. With regards to the competitive landscape, which you also brought up, I guess the one curiosity to me that I want to keep tracking is, if this was a few years ago, Platform was kind of almost alone in this space in terms of what they had. But now you've got different companies that have maybe not everything Platform was offering, but a significant overlap with companies like Adaptive Computing, Univa, Bright Computing. And I wonder whether this will touch off some kind of another wave of consolidation. Does this mean HP or Dell will want to buy one of these other companies?
Yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit about that, and I wrote that into the article with some of your feedback. I think that is a definite possibility here. It might precipitate these other deals. I mean, Platform, like we just said, is a huge middleware provider, and sort of they have dibs on it now, and that might start encouraging some of these other guys to say, okay, I need that capability in my enterprise as well. So we'll keep track of this. Obviously, there was a big move for IBM, and we'll just see how it plays out over the next months and years.
Yeah, let's go build a smarter planet.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll come back and we'll talk about Dennis Ritchie, who passed away this week.
This episode of HPC Wire Soundbite has been sponsored by NVIDIA Tesla GPUs. Visit NVIDIA at SC11, www.nvidia.com/SC11.
Well, Michael, we're coming into our last segment of our podcast this week. And, you know, and as much as we talked about Steve Jobs, the big famous Silicon Valley icon who passed away last week, this week it was one that was a lot more relevant to the HPC market in particular.
Right. Dennis Ritchie, who basically invented the C programming language and co-invented Unix, passed away. He was 70 years old.
70, right.
It's natural causes, I suppose. But, yeah, very critical person in the development of these foundational technologies for not just for HPC, obviously, for the whole industry, from PCs to servers to even mobile computing now. These are foundational technologies. Not as well known, obviously, as Steve Jobs, but a very important computer scientist who drove this technology and established this for the rest of the industry.
Yeah, when you look at the enduring impact that he's having here, starting with C as the creator of C. C, really, there's three dominant languages in HPC right now. C++, which is a later derivative of C, and Fortran. So you've got two-thirds of that all being all still enduring from his influence in computer language, to say nothing of the fact that he was the co-author of the definitive book on C programming, just called the C programming language, or commonly referred to as K&R, after the authors Brian Kernighan and Dennis Ritchie. Ritchie right. is the R in K&R.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was, like you said, that was the definitive book on C programming. It's sort of a Bible to, or at least in its day, was a Bible to a lot of software engineers and programmers that grew up in the latter quarter of the 20th century, and even today, it's like this classic.
Yeah, absolutely, and you've got a lot of old-time programmers out there who are taking a moment of silence, I think, remembering his influence. And then you've got Unix, is the co-developer of Unix with Ken Thompson, and now the share of Unix itself has fallen, but the dominant share of HPC operating systems now is Linux, which right. is really a variant of Unix. I mean, it is Unix, right?
Right, right. It's the open source follow on to Unix, and yeah, obviously that wouldn't have happened without the Unix technology there to start with. But yeah, those technologies will endure in different forms. Like you said, C to C++, Unix to Linux, as well as other technologies like C++. You know, sort of the model for Java and some of the other languages
yes,
as well.
C Sharp, Java, right, are all downstream derivatives of those earlier languages.
Yeah, I mean, Ritchie wasn't a household name. He was a computer scientist. He worked behind the scenes. If you're in the industry, you certainly did know him. But if you're not in the industry, you probably did not know him. But he had as big an influence as some of the other people we've been talking about in the past. So,
yeah, fantastic contributions to HPC. We all owe Dennis Ritchie our gratitude.
Yeah, we sure do. Well, I think that wraps it up for the week. That was a lot of news this week. We're gearing up. We're just a month away, basically, from SC. So things are not going to slow down, I don't think. More news on
No, it's going to be busy.
On the horizon, yep. So until next week, Addison, good talking to you as always.
Great. Thanks a lot.
All right.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.